From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Some parts of the city are without electricity because of the fires. Among the buildings burned down, a branch library, and the field office of a member of the Los Angeles City Council. Also, hundreds of stores and businesses, all told, more than 1,000 buildings have already been set on fire. Violent reaction to yesterday's not guilty verdict against the Los Angeles police officers, against four Los Angeles police officers, has spread to many other cities around the country.
This week marks the 10th anniversary of the Los Angeles uprising. We'll go to the sounds of the streets. Then, a conversation with anti-globalization activist Maude Barlow on Blue Gold, the fight to stop the corporate theft of the world's water.
Most people don't know that the world is running out of water. We're depleting, polluting, and diverting the world's supply, and the big corporations are moving in because there's a lot of money to be made.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Israel has again decided not to cooperate with a UN inquiry into the attack on the Jenin refugee camp for now. The decision's in defiance of a call by the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan to allow his fact-finding team to begin working immediately. The Times of London is reporting the fact-finding mission is prepared to abort its mission if it doesn't get permission to proceed from the Israeli cabinet today. The Times also reports Israeli officials are fueling rumors that the U.S. agreed to a Ramallah-Jenin deal, under which Israel had agreed to lift the siege on Yasser Arafat in return for Washington's help in blocking the Jenin inquiry. U.S. officials are vehemently denying the allegations. In Ramallah, Israeli troops and tanks are still besieging Arafat's headquarters, despite claims by Israel's defense minister that Arafat is free to travel. Meanwhile, Israeli tanks are maintaining their grip on Hebron. After killing at least 9 Palestinians there, troops ransacked homes, smashed equipment, emptied cupboards, and loudspeaker warnings of a curfew. In Bethlehem, Israeli troops shot and killed another Palestinian yesterday in the garden of the Church of the Nativity. Israeli troops have besieged the church for over 3 weeks, and those inside have been trying to pick herbs and lettuce from the garden to eat. U.S. sources said yesterday a deal ending the siege was close, but the London Independent reports Palestinian negotiators broke off talks after the shooting, saying they would not resume until Israeli soldiers stopped firing on the church and allowed in food and medicine. Newsweek is reporting the Czech intelligence tip, which supposedly revealed a link between Iraq and the September 11th attack, is looking very flimsy. The Czech government provided the CIA last fall with intelligence suggesting hijacker Mohammed Atta met with an Iraqi agent in Prague in the months before the attack. Advocates of a U.S. war in Iraq seized on the account to bolster their arguments. New York Times columnist William Sapphire proclaimed the meeting an undisputed fact connecting Saddam to September 11th. But Newsweek reports the Czechs quietly acknowledged months ago they may have been mistaken about the whole thing, and U.S. intelligence and law enforcement officials now believe Atta wasn't even in Prague at the time the Czechs claimed. Meanwhile, Iraq is preparing to back down on its refusal to allow U.N. weapons inspectors to return to the country amid reports that the U.S. is planning an invasion of Iraq early next year. The Iraqi foreign minister is to begin 3 days of talks in New York tomorrow with U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan to discuss the weapons inspectors and sanctions. Pakistanis are voting today on whether to give military ruler Pervez Musharraf 5 more years as president. Musharraf is expected to win despite boycott calls from most of the main political parties. The referendum circumvents the legal electoral process. British forces will give most al-Qaeda or Taliban fighters they capture to Afghanistan's interim government, not the United States. The decision comes after British authorities concluded the fighters should be given prisoner of war status, which makes their imprisonment subject to international law. The U.S. has refused to give its prisoners POW status in defiance of other governments and international human rights organizations. France has officially returned to South Africa the remains of a young woman who was taken from her home and displayed as a freak show attraction in the 19th century. Sarchi Bartman's remains were handed over on Monday at a ceremony at the South African embassy that capped years of negotiations between the two countries. She was exhibited in Britain and France as the Hottentot Venus. The German state of Hamburg is planning to offer African countries at least $8,000 a head to accept rejected asylum seekers. The plan is aimed at black Africans who refuse to identify their country of origin so they can't be deported. They would be sent against their will to an African country willing to take the money. The plan is the brainchild of Ronald Schill, a former judge who was swept into office last year on a wave of fear and anti-immigrant sentiment following September 11th. The London Guardian reports the proposal is bound to raise fears of an all-out push by the far right in Europe to capitalize on Jean-Marie Le Pen's astonishing success in the first round of the French presidential election. Eight Italian police officers have been placed under house arrest. Hundreds of others are being investigated for brutality during global justice protests a year ago. The eight officers are accused of beating and humiliating demonstrators after kidnapping them from the hospital casualty wards after protests in Naples ahead of the G8 summit in Genoa. An investigator's report in Naples concluded the police barracks had been converted into a, quote, torture chamber, a fetid cesspit of urine, feces, vomit, and blood. The report quoted a female protester who was suffering from panic attacks after being stripped and sexually humiliated by officers. Others were disabled from beatings, and others had been forced to sing fascist-era songs or kiss portraits of Mussolini. The move has infuriated the center-right government of Silvio Berlusconi, while reviving left-wing charges from that Italy's shift to the right has encouraged fascist tendencies in the police force. President Bush visited South Central Los Angeles yesterday to mark the 10th anniversary of the Los Angeles uprising. The uprising was sparked when a suburban California court acquitted four white police officers who were videotaped beating African-American Rodney King. President Bush used the anniversary to promote his plans to allow religious groups to take on social service functions traditionally performed by government, especially in the fight against poverty. The plan has stalled in the Congress. We'll have more on the uprising in a minute.
He holds no promise other than learning for today. Things may look the same outside the window frame, but wind has rustled the branches. Leaves have abandoned our familiar. Colors fade to winter pale. Peering out, I often see tomorrow, bundled up warm and tight, holding her mother's hand. She checks both ways before crossing the street. The snow, crunchy beneath her feet, she imagines walking on the moon. Unlike television, this glass box captures present moments, fleeting seconds reflective in scope, because we will never be here again. Like memory free from hindsight, the pain is in need of repair. There's much work to be done.
And that was from Poets for Peace, Quraish Ali Lansana. You are listening to Resistance Radio. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This week is the 10th anniversary of one of the largest uprisings in modern U.S. history, the uprising in Los Angeles sparked by the acquittal of four white police officers who beat Rodney King. On April 29, 1992, an all-white jury acquitted four white police officers, this despite a videotape that showed the officers hitting King with their batons over 50 times, kicking him and shooting him with an electronic stun gun as he lay on the ground. After the videotape was broadcast, a grand jury indicted all four officers on a number of charges. The world assumed a guilty verdict was inevitable. But then the judge moved the trial to Simi Valley, a largely white enclave in conservative suburbia. He ruled the officers could not be guaranteed an impartial trial in Los Angeles. Many felt they could not get an impartial trial in Simi Valley. A few months later, the jury acquitted the officers of all charges. An hour and 15 minutes later, after the acquittal came down, what will be remembered forever as the L.A. riots, or the L.A. rebellion, began. 10 years ago, fires spread throughout the streets of South Central, Long Beach, Hollywood, Koreatown, and West Los Angeles. 55 people were killed, more than 2,300 people were injured, more than 1,100 buildings were damaged or destroyed, more than 13,000 National Guard and federal officers were called in by President Bush Sr. And most of the 10,000 people arrested were Latino and black young men. Today we go to the sounds of the streets and the memories of those who were there. The Rodney King Uprising, 10 years later, is an audio documentary produced at Pacifica affiliate station KPFK in Los Angeles. It's produced by Armando Godino, associate producer and editor Nathan Thompson. Among the people who you hear are Warren Caton, gay activist with PVT, business owner in West Hollywood, Oscar Vergara, a teacher and activist, Pastor Brian McKnight, Baptist Church, South Central Los Angeles, a church that's been in South Central for over 90 years, Roxana Hernandez, immigrant worker from El Salvador, Miguel Paredes, Boys and Girls Club in East Los Angeles, Maxine Waters, congressman from the area, and more. This is the Rodney King Uprising 10 years later.
There is a very fast-moving situation here. I call it something similar to a high-tech revolt.
I was about 16 years old, and I remember coming home from school that day. It was, you know, pretty clear that something was going to happen regarding the case, because there was a lot of tension in the city at that time.
Many colleges and universities in the Los Angeles metropolitan area canceled classes tonight and tomorrow. Major League Baseball and basketball games have been postponed, and people are rushing to stock up on candles and batteries as night approaches here. Some parts of the city are without electricity because of the fires. Among the buildings burned down, a branch library, and the field office of a member of the Los Angeles City Council. Also, hundreds of stores and businesses, all told, more than 1,000 buildings have already been set on fire. Violent reaction to yesterday's not guilty verdict against the Los Angeles police officers, against four Los Angeles police officers, has spread to many other cities around the country.
That afternoon, I saw it on television at home. I rather had thought something like that would happen, because I had several parishioners call me and kind of make a plea. Pastor, something's about to go down here. I wish some men like you and other leaders could try to head this thing off, but I'm hearing anger and hostility. I think something's going to go off here. I left the church with that kind of ringing in my ear that evening. And then, of course, when I looked on television, the verdict, and it was not long before I could see things. And I kind of lived kind of, I could look down on the city, and I saw the fires, you know, erupting and breaking out, and I could smell the smoke. When I saw that, I was very sad. I had hoped that we would not drift into that. We would not fall into that, but it was sad. It was very sad. And it's kind of like you don't ever know when it's going to be over, you know. And then you see somebody on the television say it's not over until we say it's over.
It is a sad time in America and a very painful time for those of us who struggle with the question of justice and equality in this country. Rodney King has been harmed. The system did not work. There has been a miscarriage of justice. The venue should never have been changed. He was sent to have his fate meted out to him in Simi Valley, an all-white community where over 2,000 Los Angeles police officers live. Those police officers have the support of that community. Their families, their relatives, their neighbors support them. Rodney King did not stand a chance once that venue had been changed.
I don't think anybody expected them to be acquitted. I don't think anybody expected the reaction to be as massive and as sudden and as uncontrolled as it's been in Los Angeles. Up here, of course.
The mass of the few in this tornation. The priest, the book of the congregation. Politics who rob and hold down your zone. For those who give the thieves the key.
At that point, I was trying to think about it. My employees were basically street kids. I believe I had three street kids I had hired and one, the first of my ghetto kids. So we started hearing about it on the radio and going, wait a second, what's happening? You know, couldn't quite believe it. And then the kids said, well, can we go home? Because Everything, the traffic was slowing down. People weren't coming in. So I let them go, and I started getting scared as I listened to the radio. And I ran home, brought over a TV here so I could watch and see what's happening. And then, oh, excuse me. Okay, now I'm starting to cry because I'd forgotten this. I forgot about watching on TV, watching those that intersection at, what was it, Florence and whatever, and watching the police cars go by and watching them beat this guy with rocks, with concrete blocks, hitting him, and the police are just driving through, and I'm hearing news that Chief, what was his name, was at a party in Beverly Hills and didn't want to be interrupted it, and that he was keeping track of what was happening by watching the TV just like I was, and yet he wasn't there.
I was living in the Union section, Third and Union, and that's where everybody started burning out stuff. I couldn't go out because I was younger by then. I was 10 years. I was probably 16 years old. So all I remember was watching TV, and when it started, we were walking toward the liquor store there, and I just remember that the owner didn't let nobody go in. He was standing in front of his door with a gun, and nobody could go in. So we went back home, and we turned on the TV, and we saw that, maybe two blocks from our house, everybody was burning out stuff. I got scared because, like I said, it was just a couple blocks from my house. And, my parents were even more scared because they actually thought that people were going to come over and, get in the house and rob us or do stuff like that. But I had never seen anything like that. I grew up in El Salvador. I was little. I came here when I was 5. I had never seen any kind of violence like that, just in movies. But I never thought it could happen, just a couple blocks from my house.
What has amazed me so far is that in most of the conversation I've heard on the television and on the radio, and the few things I've read in print, nobody has, in a sense, gone through the issue of injustice in the Rodney King case to the real issue, which I think we're seeing on the television. What we're watching, and what everybody is calling looting, is the only form of redistribution of wealth that's going to take place in most of these people's lifetime.
My name's Anna Anaya, and I've been here at this location, 3529 South Central, for about 16 years, since about 88. People thought I was crazy to come out here and open an office here, because I used to have another office more mid-Wilshire area. So when I told them, no, I was moving here to South Central, they told me, well, what are you going to do in South Central? But there's a lot of Hispanic community out here, and there were no services, so we ventured out here, and we've been here since then.
Looting has now spread to Hollywood Boulevard, with a restaurant near the Capitol Records building burning down. Looting and arson.
I always put the news in the morning, so it just started happening. I think by mid-afternoon, there was a Pioneer Chicken here across the street, and it just burned to the ground. And a lot of people were panicking, a lot of people were afraid, a lot of people were putting black-owned in their building, my landlady, she was African-American, she already passed away, but she called me that day and she told me, how things were, and I said, well, things are getting really crazy and I'll probably end up locking up and leaving, see what happens. And she says, well, don't worry and take care of yourself, basically. But other than that, then the police started moving in and stuff, and we did close down that day, but a little fearful. I didn't put any kind of sign or anything on the door, and I guess we had been here already for maybe 4-5 years, going on 5 years, so people in the community really knew us, so they really didn't touch the building or anything. So I guess we got lucky.
I came down to my house, and she had told me, hey, look, the TV, the city's on fire. I see, fires breaking out everywhere and everything. And, the whole city was on fire and stuff. And I was just like, whoa. So I was down the street with my partner, Darren. And when my other partner across the street got home, he came home with a pickup truck that he had. He does mechanic work. And we got his pickup truck, and we took off in his pickup truck. And we went down over on Hooper and Florence and started to clean. We hit this liquor store out. As we got there, all the gates were coming down. And we just went up in there, and we just like a free-for-all, and we just went for it and just started cleaning everything loose, tearing the place loose. You know what I mean? We had pipes and boards and everything, went up in there. We got all the beer clean, all the beer, cigarettes, everything. We just went for it. It was like a big old free-for-all. The whole city was like, you know, it was just like a free-for-all.
No, Sonny. I was sitting here watching TV. I said, let them do what they want to do out there. Because I didn't even care. Because I went to work that day. You know what I mean? I didn't care. But I can do about it. Let the Stony Boys take care of it. Oh. I didn't care. Well, what they was doing. What could I do about it? Firestone will take care of it. I couldn't do nothing about it. I had no control. I just said it was stupid and ignorant. Why do I want to call all this chaos? Why do I want to do it? I didn't care. We really didn't care. I'm just sitting right here where I'm sitting right now. These couches is old. Watching my TV. Why should I go out down the street and try to control something? I wasn't that stupid. I'm too old to fight. Let them do what they want to do. I didn't really care. I'm sorry. That's the way I feel about it. That's the way I felt about it.
We want to again remind people that in Los Angeles, apparently the city is virtually shut down with a curfew. It's, of course, one of the measures that authorities are using to try to control some of the violence that has erupted in the wake of the Rodney King verdict. We understand, by the way, the AP wire service says that apparently 14 people have been killed. CBS
what happened with Mr. King was so obviously blatantly wrong. And to get the verdict that actually came down, I think it was just kind of like the last straw. I think people felt that they had been taken advantage of. They had been, well, like they say in the community, they had been dissed.
Yeah, people standing around watching someone hit someone. That's wrong. And there's no way to justify it in my mind. It shouldn't happen. You know, we have handcuffs. You can handcuff people. There are a lot of other things you can do. But what I saw on the videotape was unacceptable under any standards of law enforcement in a democracy.
You know, the community just was fed up. I mean, it was just like, oh, no, you know, absolutely not. You cannot get away with that one. And it was just wrong. It was just certainly wrong what happened. And yes, the people were angry and they were mad and they were upset and they were ready to hurt something, kill something, throw something. You know, it's just like that was the anger and that was the... Because of the disrespect and the injustice that the police department showed us as a people and black men in general. So I understood the brothers' anger and I understood, you know, their pain of being abused and being kicked and beaten and, you know, stopped, you know, for a traffic ticket and end up with a bullet in your head. You know, it was just like, and it was like it was going on and on and on, and you were hearing about it so much, and then to actually witness it on TV, it was like, okay, enough is enough. So when that verdict rang out, it was like, no, this is not going to happen. And so I understood the anger and the pain, and I did feel it myself. So I was a part of that feeling.
People are angry. People are frustrated. The violence certainly is senseless, but we don't know what to say to people who feel they have no outlet. People sincerely felt that that videotape was descriptive enough to have rendered a guilty verdict in all of those counts.
Los Angeles Congressmember Maxine Waters and many other voices on the Rodney King uprising 10 years later. Back in a minute.
Forces on
the same that burn crosses. Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that work forces draw the same that burn crosses.
Killing in the name of Rage Against the Machine here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with the documentary produced at Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, the Rodney King Uprising 10 years later.
My name is Oscar Vergara. I'm a teacher with LAUSD, and as an active participant of the, let's call it, rebellion, riots is a harsh word to use, concerning the circumstances, not much has changed. I mean, the Heal LA program came in and left. People made, I call them poverty pimps, you know, made a lot of money out of OT for, you know, certain programs that really the problem is still here. You know, we have a high rate of gang violence. Certain areas like in Lincoln Heights, I mean, people are actually marching for more cops on the streets, you know. And that's a different area of the neighborhood. Here hasn't changed. You still see vacant lots that never came back. Koreans have maybe went to Korea or just never came back. Now they're being bought up by small Vietnamese, Chinese, Japanese peoples. But, you know, it's the same thing. You know, it's there's no community job. There's no I work in the neighborhood. You know, we work in downtown LA. We work in Culver City. We work in Orange County in the Valley. There are no jobs here. The people that have, let's say, a mediocre life are, for the most part, you know, hardworking people that the riots just put a big hindrance on them. You know, we didn't move. We our schools are still overcrowded. We haven't built anything. We have less, let's say, per capita land than, let's say, the Valley. And that's probably why they want to break up, because they want to keep a bigger piece of the pie. And they owe us. And that's why they agreed to pay L.A. something like $5 million every year. Why? Because we gave them all the money, you know, all the generations of L.A. City booming of the working ended up in the Valley. That's where the people lived, and they came to work in L.A. Here, there's nothing, you know.
You would hear of brutality. You could get some stories. Some of the young men in our congregation would have unpleasant kinds of experiences. Let's see, 92, my son was an officer then. He still is an officer, and he would tell us of reports of things going on. The fact about it is, he told me to be ready. We were keeping our grandchildren, and so we, you know, kind of stayed in the house and stuff like that, because he thought something was, quote unquote, going down.
Well, having those street kids working with me and everything, I've always been on the side, or basically, I am on the side of the hoods. I'm on the side of the poor. I just look at it from their point of view. And I think what led up to it was the fact that Chief Parks, as an example of us white people, just don't have any understanding whatsoever of what it is to be poor, to be broke, to be jobless. I talk to my neighbors around here, because I'd been hiring these street kids and so forth, their questions were always, so, well, why didn't they get a job before? Not realizing it took a damn fool like me to hire them, because if you're going to live on the streets, you got to be into drugs or alcohol or both. There's a lot of things you got to do to live on the streets. So you got to accept you're not hiring, you're hiring people that have problems. And these kids have problems, but to me, it's just obvious. It's just normal. You got no hope. Hiring the first kid, Frank, from the ghetto, and hearing his stories about what his family, you know, his mother had been on welfare for years, and he had brothers and sisters, not brothers, but sisters all by a different father, and how they live, I don't understand how they live, but they certainly had no hope. But they thought they did, and of course they always think they're middle class.
I think it still lies in the boardroom. And in the boardroom, for the most part, it's still Anglo, male dominated. You might have your sprinkled white woman, but for the most part, she has the same ideology as the man, conservative, looking out for their own. Until that boardroom changes, anything below that, any community committees, ad hocs, what have you, are, in my opinion, meaningless, because the figure, the head has to be, let's say, chopped off. And that hasn't been done. I mean, they're still there. I mean, we might not have the Bracero program, but we have, let's say, immigrants lined up with visas from other countries, you know. There's no change still on the bottom. You know, the people that do vote, you know, let's take what happened in Miami. You know, look at that big fiasco. You know, where's the power of the vote? You know, yes, we could go vote, and we have voted in numbers, and we've had people get up there. But let's say, for example, in the black community, what happened to, you know, Mr. Bernard Parks, you know? They did the voting. James Hounds convinced the black people to vote for him, and they voted for him. Now look what he's done to the black folks. And you hear this in, you know, in talk, small talk. You know, we're going to get that man. He did us wrong. You know, we fell for it. Well, everybody's been falling for it. And why? Because that big top board hasn't changed, you know. His daddy did a lot of things for his community. But what has he done for us lately? Not much.
Some of us met this morning with the Attorney General. We're not asking for an assessment. We're asking them to prosecute. We believe that they're guilty. Most of America believe that these officers are guilty. Los Angeles is under siege. This violence could spill over into many other cities in this country.
I don't really blame anybody, but I do think that sometimes, yeah, the cops are a little unfair with other people. I don't know if, you know, with just with white people or just with black people. No, I think they're just unfair with, you know, with the community, you know, because, you know, I know a lot of white people that are poor like me, and, you know, and I've heard them, you know, just say, oh, well, you know, the cop, you know, they just pulled me over because, you know, I'm driving a nice car, but I'm bald, and, you know, and they are white, and it's happened a lot. So, you know, I do blame in part the cops, but then also some people just, you know, they just want to be out there having fun and not letting nobody tell them anything.
I think the power structure that's in place is definitely at fault here. I don't think that the riots were an expression so much of outrage over the incident with Rodney King as much an expression of outrage over the power structure that oppressed the minority people. So I think that if we had to blame somebody, we would have to blame the power structure that oppresses and marginalizes sections of people and masses of people at the periphery of the core group of decision makers.
What we needed was, according to that commission who set up, is community policing, where the police got to know the members of the community and started to have some understanding. I see them drawing back further away from the community, so that the community can go crazy, do their stupid things, and then they can come in heavier. I see it on a national level of condemning the poor for what they are, and, well, like what's happening in Israel right now, trashing the Palestinians, leaving them no kind of infrastructure, and then watching them go crazy.
Well, I think I saw the community kind of come together. I know we opened up food. We were serving food to people who had been burned out or were without work because of businesses having been destroyed, and we gave clothing. We collected clothing and gave clothing, and I sensed the community start coming together. It seems like I think we had the president visit with a meeting over here at Dr. Hill's church. The president visited, and Cardinal Mahoney gave very inspiring, encouraging kinds of talks. And things just seemed to kind of come together. The wounds, efforts were being made to heal the wounds, and I think goodwill was generated. And then some of the federal programs that were supposedly coming through and being heralded as coming through to give some relief to some of the distress that was in the community. I think all of that was good, and it gave people hope.
Now I drive by that where I used to live before, and yeah, they've opened more stores, you know, all those stores that used to be there before the riot. Now they're Home Depots or they're, you know, places like that. But, you know, not a lot has changed, but yeah, I've seen some changes where I used to live before.
I happen to work in a night school, and it is in South Central, but that's because of the rigor that we put in our students' mind. You have to work. We set the bar a little bit higher. I go to school with 3,000 kids, and out of 3,000 kids, we have a lot of intellectuals, a lot of 50 and above Stanford 9 scores that you don't find in these neighborhoods. You find single digits. Ours are double digits and beyond. So what we want to strive is a school setting that is not just because we're in South Central, we're going to be not, let's say, give you homework or be easy on you because you listen to the helicopters every night, so we're going to be easy. No, we set the bar actually higher. So in our school is a special case. But in the most part around us, I mean, the gamut runs from, you know, administrators siphoning money, you know, teachers, you know, doing their own things and not teaching. We have such a wide scenario of worst-case scenarios that the education is not being put through. The other one is the political committees, of course, in Sacramento that keep the teachers' wages down. And maybe that might be a response to teachers saying, well, you know, if I don't get paid like a professional, then I'm not going to teach like a professional. But it is changing in some schools. But for the most part, in South Central, not much has changed. You still have the white teacher that comes from the suburbs coming in to teach, who gets here late, who leaves right when the bell rings after school, does not want to stay after school and tutor or help out with a coaching or anything to improve the community, you know. And in those after-school programs are vital, and we don't have no personnel for them. They're gone. You know, the school parking lot is ghost town at, let's say, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. At our school, it's full still. The money hasn't been pumped into L.A. like it should have been. All the federal money that was funneled through the state into the city never got actually to South Central. It's been absorbed up by bureaucrats. There are some loans here and there that were given out. I'm not going to doubt that, but it didn't reach its height that it should have reached. We should have seen more beautification of South Central like we see in other parts of the city where there was no, let's say, riots. So we're still getting the lower end of the stick.
Prior to 92, it was a little bit more harder. There was a little more violence, more gang activity. It was hard being here. It wasn't easy. But then after the riots happened, the neighborhood started changing a lot. The new police station brought a lot of peace of mind. And things have been good since then. The neighborhood has really changed. There's more business now. You know, people are looking to buy homes around this area. So it's changed a lot.
There are many more other nationalities that have certainly moved into the community and bought some of those very stores that African Americans will burn out of. So certainly I've seen an increase of Asian community here, and in reference to the interaction with the community, it seems that they do understand where they are now, that they are sharing our community, and so it is a different kind of a communication, not the stand around following the store, watch every move you make kind of attitude, more like, okay, let the cameras do the watching and, you know, just kind of sit back and, you know, still be on point and be secure. But, you know, it's not that kind of energy where you used to walk in the store and be like, why are you following me around? What, you know, what is... So I've seen that change to a degree, and witnessed that they have. The Korean community has certainly tried to do a better outreach program in terms of, you know, collective effort in the community and communication with African Americans and other nationalities in the community.
The Rodney King Uprising, 10 years later, an audio documentary produced at Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. It was produced by Armando Gudino and associate producer and editor Nathan Thompson, contributing producers Christopher Sprinkle, Eben Ray, Maria Kim, and Zubery Fields, with music by Rage Against the Machine. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, the wars of the next century will be about water. Stay with us.
There's not much left to believe in, but the hearts of the fools and the children. Good earth is stripped of her gift.
God save us from ourselves. Willella from the CD Unbearable Love here on Democracy Now!, breaking the sound barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, I was flying back this weekend from Columbia, Missouri, where I met lots of listeners from KOPN, the nation's eighth oldest community radio station in the country, and it was wonderful to meet everyone. It wasn't quite as wonderful as we flew over LaGuardia Airport for 1 hour, and then 2 hours, and then 3 hours. The pilot said, at some point, we have an hour left of fuel, and 55 minutes later, we started to get a little nervous. Anyway, it was all because there was too much water outside. It was raining in New York on Sunday night, and I found myself inside as the hours went on, asking for more and more water myself. I wasn't sure why I was so thirsty. Maybe it had something to do with the book I was reading, Blue Gold, The Fight to Stop the Corporate Theft of the World's Water, by well-known anti-corporate globalization activists Maud Barlow and Tony Clark. And Maud Barlow joins us in our Firehouse studio today. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
It's great to have you with us. Well, it is a shocking expose that'll awaken people around the world. Your book shows why, as the vice president of the World Bank has pronounced, the wars of the next century will be about water. Increasingly, transnational corporations are plotting to control the world's dwindling water supply. In England and France, where water has already been privatized, rates have soared and water shortages have been severe. The major bottled water producers, Perrier, Evian, Naya, and now Coca-Cola and PepsiCo, are part of one of the fastest growing and least regulated industries, buying up freshwater rights and drying up crucial supplies. You document this in this superb book, The Consumption of Water Doubling Every 20 Years, more than twice the rate of the increase of the human population. Can you go on from here and first lay out the scope of the problem, and then we'll talk about, what are the greatest causes of the possible water shortage we will all soon be facing?
Well, first of all, what I came at this from the political question, so I had to teach myself all the other part of it, which is the actual crisis and the nature of the crisis and where it exists. And I guess the first thing to say is that we have the same water in the world in our system that we had at the creation of the planet. And it's not only the same amount, it's the same water. And when you walk down the street and the rain falls down on you, some of that rain was in the blood of dinosaurs. I mean, we are literally talking about a finite, small amount of water. Fresh water represents about well less than 0.5% of the total world's water stock. That's it. It's all we've got. There's nowhere else to get any more. And humanity is depleting, diverting, and polluting that finite amount so fast now that by 2025, two-thirds of the world will be living in water-scarce reality, either very little access or absolutely no access at all. We're looking at a number of what we call hotspots in the world. The Middle East, very little talk about how much water is a part of the crisis there, with Israel taking water from the Jordan River, with the Dead Sea actually dying. It wasn't dead, that's the name of it. With crops being grown in places that absolutely shouldn't be there, so that they know there's going to be, they're going to run out of water in several of the countries in the Middle East in 50 years. Africa, 22 countries in Africa have, they're just absolutely at the breaking point now. In South Africa, the stat that stunned me was that women in just that one country alone walk the average of to the moon and back 16 times a day to get water because it's so much harder to find. Mexico City's running out. Mexico used to be an absolute oasis, kind of like the Venice of the New World. And when the Spanish came, they didn't like that. They didn't want it to look like Venice. They wanted it to look like a Spanish city. So they devastated and used slave labor to take all the water away, to remove the lakes and to dredge everything. Mexico City, they say, will be gone. The motto will be gone in 10 years. There's nowhere to go for it. They're actually talking about having to maybe move Mexico City. California. People don't realize here in the United States how much the crisis has arrived here. That in California, current rates, not even increased rates of usage, within 20 years, California will be short the amount that's needed now every day for its cities and towns. I mean, we are in a situation where even in water-rich areas of the world, like North America, we're beginning to come up against it. And so what's happening now is that as our surface water is being so damaged, and 80% of all the rivers in China are too damaged to drink, fish in, swim in, 75% of the rivers in Russia, and I mean the statistics are dreadfully similar in many places in the world, we're now turning to what are called the aquifer sources, the groundwater sources under the ground. And taking that up through modern technology at a rate far faster than nature can replenish it. 25 years ago, 30 years ago, very little water was taken from just well water that people used for their own personal use on farms. Now, a quarter of the world's water usage is coming from these underground aquifers, like the Ogallala Aquifer that runs down from South Dakota down all the way to Texas, as probably the largest aquifer in the world. And to make the deserts bloom in California, New Mexico, and to make the fountains that you see in Los Angeles, they're taking water out of the Ogallala Aquifer by 200,000 wells, 14 times faster than it can be replenished. There is actually, Amy, this is important to say, there's no disagreement on what I've just said. Left, right, and center, anybody who's examining this has agreed that we're now living on the brink of a water crisis of huge proportions. I don't think it's been put together in quite the way that we did, but it's there. Nobody's disagreeing. The question, the political question, is what to do about it. But what I've just stated, although it's not very well known, is not being disputed now by anybody.
Maud Barlow, you quote the Canadian environmentalist David Suzuki comparing the water lily on a lake. Maybe you can give us that example.
Well, he tries to explain what exponential destruction of the environment is. And he said if we could see it, if it was linear, so it was 1 plus 1 and then 2 plus 2, you could kind of see something coming at you. But when exponential destruction of the environment takes place, it's taking place, nobody can see it all. It's taking place in so many points. And he says the day before it's all gone, it might look just fine. To explain that, he says, look, there's a lake or a pond and lily pads on it. Now, it's fine. A lake can survive with lily pads, but not if it's totally covered, because if they totally cover it, oxygen will be cut off. So he says if it were linear, you could count them and you'd know when you're in trouble. But he says with exponential destruction or exponential growth of these, he said this lake is going to be covered with lily pads in 60 days. Now, what does it look like on day 59? Well, with exponential growth, 4 times 4, 8 times 8, 16 times 16, it's only half full the day before it's dead. And I think, you know, and I quote him, and I know him quite well, and I know he does think this, that he would look at the water crisis in the world now and say, it looks like we have lots. Certainly you can walk down the streets of New York or any other city, and major city in North America, and you buy all the bottled water you have, and it might be raining, or you go to places where there's still a lot of lakes, and you think, what are we talking about? There's lots of water left. In fact, by that analogy, we may be on day 59 in terms of how much water we have. It's the twin crises of pollution on one hand. Almost half of the world's population has no access to sanitation. A child dies every 8 seconds of polluted water, waterborne diseases, as we speak in this world. So there's the twin problems of pollution on one side, but actual physical water scarcity, taking good water where it belongs, using it in ways that destroys it, or allowing, and the aquifers are now finding through mining or through careless use of aquifers, they're allowing saltwater intrusion. So it's actually taking water that's fresh now and either polluting it or converting it to salt water. So we're actually diminishing the amount of available fresh water as we add, 85 million people every year to the planet. So it's the combination of overuse, pollution, and total and complete disregard for something that is finite. There's nowhere to go to get more of this.
We're talking to Maud Barlow. She is a well-known anti-corporate globalization activist in Canada, and she's just written the book with Tony Clark, Blue Gold, The Fight to Stop the Corporate Theft of the World's Water. Let's talk for a minute about the corporations. You know, there are many stories in the paper just today that people might not realize are related to water. Of course, you've got Israel and the occupied territories. You've got on one of the front pages of the Financial Times, the Vendi chief looks at purge of cash-burning internet units. And the front page of the business section of the New York Times, another piece about the Vendi. Not a lot of people have heard about this company. Can you talk about the Vendi, Suez, and then Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola?
Well, one of the aspects of privatization, of course, is the move to privatize your water delivery. And interestingly, a lot of privatizations started in North America, particularly the United States. The privatization of water started in Europe with two great big huge French companies called Vivendi and Suez. It was Suez Lyonnais des Eaux. They've just changed to Suez. Vivendi, if Americans know Vivendi now, they know it as a big company that's moving into telecommunications. But its main original function was water, and that's still the biggest division of its empire, and it's still pays for everything. Its water division is paying for its intrusion into Hollywood and buying every station that you know about here and there. So Vivendi and Suez, between them, there are 10 huge water companies, but those are the two biggest ones in terms of the delivery of water. And they have got the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund on their side promoting water privatization throughout the Third World. So much as 10, 15 years ago, the World Bank and the IMF were promoting privatized health care or education. We all know those stories through structural adjustment programs in the Third World. Now it's water privatization. And the stories are just appalling. I mean, basically, the company gets a contract where, by and large, they're guaranteed profits no matter whether a profit is turned or not. That we have well documented in there, both from Great Britain and France and South Africa and Latin America and many places that these companies have moved into. You get higher water prices. You get less good water quality. You get huge earnings for these CEOs because when you take something that's been a public service and not for profit, delivered to people because they need it, and you turn it into something that goes for full cost pricing, which is what they're basing this on, you basically have untold ability to make money. I mean, this is blue gold. This stuff people will pay any amount of money for. So that's one level of privatization. The other is, there are several others. One is the bottling of water. 10, 15 years ago, it was very rare to see a bottle of water. Now it's very rare not to. Bottled water has become very cool. Well, it's not cool. It's a form of mass insanity to let our public water systems deteriorate and to put water in boutique bottles to compete with each other all over the world. Last year, we put 84 billion liters of water in bottles, most of it plastic, most of it ending up in the rivers and streams and, you know, the meadows and the wetlands of the world. And that's increasing again exponentially. 20% a year that business is growing. Now have companies that we call water hunters that are going into countries in Latin America, parts of United States and Canada, looking for water, buying up water rights, buying up land in some areas just so that they can hold on to the water underneath the ground because they know it's going to be worth a fortune. You get companies like Nestle, which owns 68 of the big brand companies, including Perrier and San Pellegrino and lots of ones that you might think are these nice little bottle companies, you know, we all order in restaurants. They're scouring. They've got fight backs in the United States with people with the slogans, you know, go away Perrier and no way Perrier. I mean, these companies have become big transnationals.
Maud Barlow, you write in your book about Bechtel in Bolivia.
Yep.
People may have heard a few years ago, though it didn't get a tremendous amount of coverage, over the battle in Cochabamba for water. and the driving out of this large multinational based in San Francisco around the issue of privatization of water. Can you talk about that? And what might not be as well known is that Bechtel is now suing Bolivia?
What happened was the World Bank said to Bolivia in this state of Cochabamba, we want you to privatize your water system, and they introduced them to Bechtel in a very aggressive way. Bechtel came in, and which is a big American engineering company, as you know, and they set up a water company, Aguas de Tenari. This water company immediately doubled the price of water, and there was a war. People literally said, we can't afford it. I mean, this is one of the poorest countries in Latin America, 75% indigenous. They could not afford the water. They took to the streets. The army was brought in. People were arrested in the middle of the night. I mean, it was a very bad scene. People were killed. But they stayed strong. Bechtel was forced to leave the country. The World Bank was furious. It's put a very bad mark, if you will, on this World Bank process. Now Bechtel is suing the government of Bolivia for its lost future profits under what's called a bilateral investment treaty, which is very much like NAFTA. It's the same provision under NAFTA that allows a corporation to sue the government of another country if it loses, if its profits are expropriated because of any law it brings in. And it moved its holding company from the Cayman Islands to Holland because Holland had a bilateral investment agreement with Bolivia. So this is a very important demonstration of how these trade agreements work, because not only do you have the big agreements like the upcoming General Agreement on Trade and Services, the GATS, which is going to include water as a service, or the current NAFTA, which has water as a good and an investment, and now under the new Free Trade Area of the Americas, they're talking about bringing in water as a service. But you've got something like 1,700 bilateral agreements around the world. And these are agreements between countries one-on-one, which gives corporations the rights to say to other to governments, you can't bring in that piece of legislation because we'll sue you. And what they can do is that they can just move or open a subsidiary in any country with a bilateral agreement with the country in question.
So conceivably, you can have a country that says, we will not privatize our water supply as a corporation attempts to come in and do it. And then, say it's a U.S.-based company, the U.S. could bring a challenge at the level of the World Trade Organization saying you're presenting an obstacle to trade.
That's what's going to happen under the GATS. Under the WTO, yet, at this point, they still can't force privatization. That's been more the way the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund have operated. However, what's happening in Geneva as we speak is the General Agreement on Trade and Services, which is being negotiated. By the end of June this year, every country is going to have to tell every other country which services it wants that country to open up. And we just got, in another brown paper bag, we get a lot of these, the demands from the European Union of Canada and the United States, and water privatization is one of the key demands from the European Commission. Of Canada and the United States. So the process is kind of like a big rope around the neck of public water services.
Maud Barlow, we only have 10 seconds now. We're going to continue this conversation tomorrow, but give us a taste of the solutions you're recommending. Very quickly, the list.
We say that water belongs to the earth and all species and must not be privatized for profit. No one has the right to expropriate it for profit. We have to protect the world's water supply as a public commons.
And tomorrow we'll talk about the various strategies that you and your co-author, Tony Clark, are recommending. The book is Blue Gold, The Fight to Stop the Corporate Theft of the World's Water. And you are listening to Democracy Now! If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230, 1-800-735-0230. Go to our website at www.democracynow.org. That's democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner. And our music maestro and engineer is Anthony Sloan. Our email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
There's not much left.